Mm-hmm. We do have a voice. And I think that the more women get involved and start to see that, it's really empowering. And then we can really start to move the needle together.
This is A New Angle, and I'm your host, Justin Angle, marketing professor at the University of Montana. This podcast is all about creativity and hustle happening in and around the great state of Montana. Today, I got the chance to sit down with Erin Swatowski, the executive director of Women's Voices for the Earth. Women's Voices for the Earth is a very important nonprofit organization headquartered here in Missoula. They do work on a national scale, a ton of policy work and regulatory work in Washington, D.C. They've recently had some great success with negotiating with large corporations like Procter & Gamble. So their work, it really outstrips their little home here in Missoula. And in our conversation with Erin, we get into a lot of important issues. One, just kind of creating some awareness about the level of dangerous chemicals and the lack of regulations that exist involving, many household products and products that sort of are disproportionately exposed to women, and why moms and women in general are sort of, unfortunately, at the forefront of this issue. And it's interesting to hear Erin's perspective on why Women's Voices for the Earth is so dedicated to women. Another thing that's interesting too, she's got a pretty strong philosophy about, whether the world can be changed through sort of consumer action, voting with your pocketbook, or if it just needs to be more regulatory in mind and more policy driven. So we have a cool exchange about that. Anyway, Women's Voices for the Earth, they do amazing work, and I enjoyed my conversation with Erin, and I hope you do as well. Okay, so we're here today with Erin Swatowski. Thanks, Erin, for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you, Justin, for having me.
Yeah, so you are the executive director of Women's Voices for the Earth.
Yes.
Nonprofit organization headquartered here in Missoula.
Yep.
My understanding is Women's Voices for the Earth is dedicated to trying to remove chemicals from a variety of different products, but chemicals that disproportionately affect women in our community and in the world in general.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. Our mission is really to amplify women's voices to eliminate the toxic chemicals that harm our health and our communities. And so we've primarily focused on chemicals that impact women.
Okay.
We've been looking at industries in particular that heavily market and sell to women, because we think the power of women can help change these industries.
Okay, so I'd like to get into the sort of gender issue as we go, but before we get into that, can you give us a little bit of bio and how you kind of were drawn into this kind of work?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I kind of came into Women's Voices for the Earth by accident through some other work that I was doing. And I was actually engaged in an effort. We were doing an action, kind of a protest out at a Walmart with labor unions around some of their unfair labor practices. And when I was there, I met a couple of women.
And you were there just as a protester?
I was there as a protester.
Okay.
And I met a couple of women who were there from Women's Voices for the Earth.
Yeah.
And it intrigued me, because I wondered, well, why are you're an environmental organization, why are you guys here?
Sure.
And they, just really honed in on the fact that everything is interconnected, and workers' rights are environmental rights, and healthy communities rely on healthy workers and a healthy environment. And so for me, it was really a way to see the environmental movement in a much broader way. And that was really appealing to me.
Yeah.
Where before it had just been about saving the, rivers and the trees, which is great. But, we can't forget that people live in this world, and together we need to have a healthy environment.
Yeah, it kind of brings it down to earth in a way. That's terrible choice of phrase, but it kind of brings it internalizes it in a way that just feels much more tangible.
Yeah, it's very personal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so from that initial touch point, you sort of what was then your entry strategy into Women's Voices for the Earth?
Then, I started noticing the organization at multiple events, and then I heard about a job opportunity they were hiring for,
and they
were hiring for a statewide campaigns organizer for their mercury and public health campaign at the time. And so I talked to them and applied and got the job and started working as a statewide campaign organizer.
And had you been working in the nonprofit space or activism space, policy space before?
Yeah, I started off, you know, I'd really been doing a lot of work through college. So I went to University of Montana and I have a degree in Spanish, but I was engaged in political activism through my time here. I was on the board of Montpurg. I was a student senator with the Associated Students. And then I had been working with an organization called Community Action for Justice in the Americas, doing solidarity, cross-border solidarity work between Latin America and Missoula here, where we'd bring labor organizers up to talk about different different concerns that they had and kind of do solidarity organizing.
Sure.
And then I graduated and joined the AmeriCorps VISTA program and was placed at Homeward, which does affordable green-built housing here in Missoula. And so I had really been drawn to this kind of civic engagement work and was excited to have the opportunity to connect that with, you know, environmental activism as well.
Yeah. So, and Missoula is such a hotbed for this kind of just way of thinking and these sorts of organizations. And so you get in the door at Women's Voices for the Earth, and you guys are now you're doing a statewide campaign. So all of a sudden doing a bunch of travel and...
Yeah, really just focusing on my job was to build a coalition that could actually support legislation to phase out the use of mercury-containing products in the state.
Okay.
So things like our thermostats on the wall used to have mercury in them, mercury thermometers, just all this unnecessary source
that
of mercury.
Yeah, things you stick into a baby, right?
Yeah, that things you stick into a baby. And then, you know, they always break, and the mercury always comes out, or you throw the old thermostat away, and it breaks open, and then it pollutes our rivers. Mm-hmm. And so it was just really an unnecessary source, and... So we built a coalition to, with including Department of Environmental Quality, local county, Missoula County Health, Water Quality Department here.
Sure.
And then just, you know, advocates, conservation and reproductive health advocates, because this really had intersecting concerns where mercury is a great harm for pregnant women. So we built this coalition, and after a few tries at the legislative session, we did end up passing a bill that discontinued the sale of mercury-containing thermostats here in Montana.
Okay.
And that was in 2005, I think, or 2007.
Right. And you joined the organization in 2005, is that right?
Yeah.
And so the long tenure there. How long have you been executive director?
Since 2009.
And to be clear, this is not just a Missoula organization. You guys are nationwide, have a worldwide reach.
Yep.
I was looking at your board of directors, some incredibly impressive people on the team. I mean, you got world-class researchers, policymakers, influencers.
Yeah, it's exciting. We've, you know, board building has been kind of a little project of mine. I love doing it. I think it's so important to build a strong team. And there are women all over the country that care so much about this and that had such unique skills. And, you know, they're really interested in how our organization looks at so many intersections of issues. And I think there's some appeal, too, to us being a Missoula-based organization that, you know, we're not sitting inside the D.C. Beltway trying to write policies that don't actually affect people's lives because there's no lived experience in them.
Right.
So we get, you know, once a year we bring the whole board out, and they're coming out in 2 weeks, and they get to come to Montana, and we sit down and we, you know, strategize and build our organization, which is really exciting.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So let's get into why a women's organization? Why is it so, why is that a core part of the identity? Just why women's?
Yeah. So, you know, our main focus is looking at toxic chemicals.
Right.
And right now, out there in use in the environment, there are about over 80,000 of chemicals that are in use. So these are things that are put into products that are, you know, coming out of stacks through chemical processing.
Okay.
And less than 200 of them, you know, a tiny percentage of them have actually been really thoroughly evaluated for their long-term health impacts.
Yeah, can we just give an example of the sorts of ingredients and things we're...
Yeah.
Just so people who might
absolutely.
Not be... People might not even have this on their radar screen.
Yeah.
So what are some of the chemicals and why should we care about them?
So mercury is one that people are quite familiar with.
Yep,
there's
yep.
still mercury in some mascara. There's still lead in certain lipsticks. We've been doing testing of tampons and pads. We're finding things like chloroform, acetone. These are carcinogens. Phthalates is one that people have maybe started to hear a little bit about. Uh-huh. That's often found in fragrances.
Yes.
This is a chemical that's been linked to undescended testicles in newborn babies. All kinds of these, not good things. And lots of times, you know, we're just wondering, why are these things even in there? And is there something that can be used instead so that we don't have to put any of this potential risk into the products that we use?
That's a question I would have is, why? Like, how does it come to be where a chemical like mercury or something gets into a product? I mean, it must serve some useful end in terms of product performance. And then maybe there's just total neglect with regard to downstream consequences?
I think there's probably a little bit of both. And one of the questions that we're always asking, and that, you know, we do a lot of work campaigning for companies to tell us what they put in their products.
Sure, transparency.
And yeah, for transparency, not only around ingredients, but now we're really saying, and why do you put things in there? And what are the research studies that you have on these chemicals? A product may perform really well, but what studies have you done to show that it's not going to cause a health harm or an environmental harm down the line? And that stuff really isn't publicly available right now. We don't know to what extent companies are doing this kind of testing, and that's a question that we're continually pushing for and asking about.
Although it does seem that examples abound of companies that know about all the bad stuff that their either ingredients or their product or their product in general do, negative effects that they've suppressed or tried to ignore or tried to keep out of the public eye.
Yeah. One really great recent example of this is talc.
Okay.
This is it's a powder, and it's, you know, the most obvious use of it is in baby powder.
Okay.
And that's one that people are going to be familiar with, your Johnson & Johnson baby powder, their iconic product. Well, Johnson & Johnson also used to have a product called Shower to Shower, and this contained talc. And Shower to Shower was a feminine deodorizing product. So it was basically marketed to women. It was heavily marketed to women of color, which is another grave injustice, is that a lot of these products are heavily marketed to women of color.
Okay.
And they would put it in their underwear after the shower. Well, this, you know, in the 1970s, women started complaining about health problems with this. And Johnson & Johnson actually, research has been uncovered now that shows they knew since 1970 that there's a potential problem with talc. And they worked really hard to come up with a way to cover up concerns about talc instead of actually just reformulating their product. So it's now come out. They've had multiple class action lawsuits. They've lost several lawsuits because women have proven that their ovarian cancer, and some women have died from it, has been a result of their daily use of this product for, you know, 30 years.
Yeah.
And it's just for us, we just don't, you know, it's like, why? Just when a question arises, don't spend money, you know, on lawyers and marketing defense. Like, put that money into reformulating the product.
Yeah.
If you made a mistake, or, you know, if things weren't known, because right now we live in a world where you can put things in until it's proven harmful. Which it's rarely ever is, because it's very hard to trace these things back. But you really, you know, companies can really put whatever the heck they want in a product at this point in the United States. I think we have about 10 restrictions on chemicals that can be used, in particular, like in personal care products. The European Union has restricted over 1,000.
Okay.
So that just shows you a little comparison.
Why do you think it is that companies are so hesitant to make those changes? I mean, you said, why not just take, you know, admit mistake, put the money, effort, resources, all of that into coming up with a product that's safe? Why do they double down on some of these unsafe ingredients?
You know, I don't know for sure. My guess is that they're probably afraid that if they admit wrongdoing, they'll be hit with lawsuits.
Sure, yeah, litigation.
But now it's happening, you know, so they need to get out in front of these things.
Yeah.
And we're seeing companies start to do that now. Like, okay, we think this chemical is on the radar of the public. We're going to switch out of it.
Yep.
We're going to find something else.
That's still just the way you frame that. So warped. Like this, this chemical's on the radar of the public, not this chemical causes harm.
Exactly. And that's a shift we're really trying to make. Yeah. So, for example, we've done a lot of work with the cleaning products industry. And we, back at when we started our campaign in 2007, there was no ingredient disclosure for this industry whatsoever. So you go to the store, you buy a cleaning product, you really have no idea what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
We started to look into it. We started to research it, found some undesirable ingredients, things like not household names because we're not that familiar with chemical ingredients because we don't ever see them.
Yeah, we know the basics like bleach, ammonia, blah, blah,
blah. Exactly. But 2-butoxyethanol, for example, not your household chemical name, linked to high rates of asthma. So women who are cleaning a lot were just getting lots of asthma. You know, their children are getting asthma. And oftentimes, what do you do if you have, like, asthma or you're sick? You try to clean more. You try to make your house cleaner, right?
Yep.
So there was no ingredient disclosure whatsoever. And we did some market-based campaigns. We rallied, you know, supporters and women to contact companies. We called customer service lines. We organized people to do action alerts and tied that with media publicity. And companies started voluntarily disclosing ingredients. And we were getting more and more voluntary disclosure until just last year we actually passed legislation in California that now requires manufacturers to disclose ingredients in cleaning products.
Okay.
And that the companies came to the table to sit and negotiate that because the writing was on the wall. Like, they're going to have to do this, so they want to be part of the legislation to actually, you know.
But at least that's a collaborative approach.
Yeah, I mean, it took some nudging, and it takes some nudging, but and that's where we're headed now is, okay, we have ingredient disclosure, and now we've built a roadmap to help companies ask the right questions about their chemical safety process.
Okay.
Because we don't want to chase down one chemical at a time, like that's just exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
It's exhausting for them, it's exhausting for us, you know, it's exhausting for consumers who are just trying to get safe products.
Well, and it kind of gets you too in the minutiae. I mean, not that that's unimportant, but for you guys, like in terms of messaging, it's much more, not to chase a one particular chemical.
Yeah. And we can use one chemical to give, to showcase what's broken.
Yeah.
That's worked really well. But we, you know, we still don't even know what all of the chemicals are in these products. And so the idea is, how do we get companies to stop making products that are, you know, not super risky for everyone, but instead inherently safe at their base?
Okay.
That's what we're ultimately aiming for.
Yeah.
So that nobody has to be a chemist at the grocery store. Like, that's ridiculous.
It is. It's just too hard.
Yeah.
So
it's too overwhelming.
You know, and Aaron, I mean, I kind of meandered with a bunch of different questions, but the question I did ask you minutes ago was, you know, why a women's organization?
Yeah.
You've talked a little bit about this with regard to how many of these chemicals sort of are, you know, women are more exposed to them on average than men in general, but... So why focus on the women, the feminine piece?
Yeah. So a couple of reasons for that. One is that when it comes to toxic chemicals, a lot of the chemical studies that have been done right now, the research subject has been an adult, you know, 160-pound male in an occupational setting.
Okay.
So we know that, you know, women are typically smaller than that. And they've also typically just looked at acute health impacts, so short-term things like coughing or skin irritation, things like that. But we know that women are different, and we also know that women have reproductive systems that are very complicated and different. I think historically there's just been under research on women's bodies in general. And when it comes to this question around the impact of toxic chemicals on women's bodies, this has been woefully under-researched.
Yeah.
And then we also do see the higher rates of exposure through certain products. So
it seems like the cosmetic industry is a classic example.
It's a classic example. Women on average use, you know, 15 cosmetic products a day. Even if you're, you know, someone here in Missoula that doesn't wear much makeup.
Sure. How about men? Do you know the data? I mean, what's the
average? I think the average is maybe 5.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, because you still use some shampoo, some lotion maybe, deodorant, maybe cologne.
Toothpaste in that?
Maybe hair gel, toothpaste. Yep. And so, you know, all of those things add up pretty quickly.
Okay.
So that's, and then the other reason we focus on women is that we very much believe women are going to be the change makers in this realm.
Sure.
You know, when you look at data around women and how they engage in voting on these issues, they, regardless of what party they're from, women tend to vote in favor of environmental issues more than men. Yeah. Women tend to vote in favor of policies that are health protective for their families. So when you, you know, regardless of what party they're from, regardless of what income level they're from.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and also women tend to be more engaged in their community. So you see a lot of women at PTAs, involved at church, involved in book clubs, involved in all kinds of activities. These are the women who are going to make change in this industry. And we're seeing that happen.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of this is based on, to some degree, on traditional gender roles, but a lot in many instances, women are making a lot of the frontline choices on what chemicals are interacting with their children.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. I think there's, you know, the stat that's out there is that women tend to make about 80 to 85% of the purchasing choices for their household and about 80% of the healthcare choices in a household.
So I guess the question I'm getting at, and I don't really have an elegant way of asking it other than, you know, a lot of activist-oriented organizations think about, you know, this, well, in a perfect world, men and women, you know, these chemicals affect all humans.
Yeah.
Let's not sort of, I don't know if embrace is the right word, but let's not sort of acknowledge the premise of these traditional gender roles, whereas your organization appears to say, hey, this is the way, this is what the stats are saying. Let's attack the issue where it matters most. Is that
an accurate way? It is. What I always like to, when I'm talking about cleaning, for example, I always like to say, you know, we don't focus on cleaning products because we think women should be cleaning.
Right.
We focus on it because the reality is that they are. You know, the stats still show that in an average household, women still do 70% of the cleaning. You know, they're using more of the personal care products. And a lot of this is because of the marketing.
Yes.
You know, the reality is that when you watch, it's starting to change, and I'm excited to see that. But in reality, when you watch commercials, you know, mostly they're marketing to women to do the cleaning marketing, you know, heavily marketing to women around cosmetics and putting out standards of cleanliness, standards of beauty, you know, putting out these ideas that women are, you know, buying into. So we're trying to shift that. Like, okay, well, we're not going to buy into your standard of clean. Clean for me doesn't need to smell like a pine forest, because actually that pine forest smell is a whole bunch of different chemicals mixed together and we don't know what they are.
Yeah.
And it's actually makes me sneeze and cough anyway, you know, or whatever it might be. Or we've taken on the feminine care products. I mean, this has been shocking that, you know, it's just sort of unbelievable how little research has been done about potential health impacts of feminine care products on a woman's body. I mean, basic, like there's just some basic stuff that companies don't do. They don't know how a product is interacting with what's called the vaginal biome. Like, how is the pH balance working? How is it? Things are very sensitive and dynamic, and companies just kind of slap pH balance labels on these feminine wash products.
Sure.
Those products, we found they contain things like octoxinol 9, which is a spermicide. It's not labeled as a spermicide. So women are sometimes buying products that they don't even know have a spermicide in. They might be trying to get pregnant.
Gosh,
you know, it's just these really basic things that I think have been ignored because we haven't really been out there asking these questions. With feminine care, it's been pretty taboo to even talk about for years. So that has really gone under the radar, and I think companies have just kind of enjoyed doing whatever they're doing without a lot of scrutiny until now.
Do you think it's a blind spot that comes from maybe a male-dominated sort of product development regime or managerial? You know, I'm just trying to imagine the corporate structure that leads to these sorts of products with these sorts of ingredients.
Yeah, I think that could be some of it, and then I think, too, it's just there's real lack of data. And, you know, right now what the industry tends to do is equate lack of data with safety. And that is just a really bad precedent that's been set.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, you have kindergartners. In kindergarten, you learn, you know, let's better safe than sorry. That is not how.
Nobody's falling in that hole in the classroom yet. I guess it's safe.
Exactly. You know, exactly. So unfortunately, we live in this other paradigm right now where it's like, well, until a whole bunch of people get really, really hurt, we don't really have to change the way we do business.
Yeah.
Or until somebody asks enough questions and makes us look bad enough, we don't really have to change the way we do business.
Which, you know, I mean, I'm trying to not necessarily play devil's advocate here, but you're trying to think about how, like, good people can fall into these traps, right? And so it might come from a place where you develop a product, you feel like it meets needs, it provides a benefit in the marketplace.
Yeah.
And that all's well and good. And maybe you've ignored certain negative consequences that you didn't think of.
Yep.
But then it starts making money, right? And then you have to make your earnings reports for shareholders.
Yeah.
And all those things, I can see how those would contribute to, oh, we found a problem. Well, let's ignore that. Let's not open that door, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's true. And I think that's why our organization has to exist. You know, we worked really hard to connect with Procter & Gamble for years and years and years, and we were not getting very far. And so we decided to meet them on their home ground, and we showed up at their annual shareholder meeting.
Okay.
And since then, we've been talking to them every 2 to 3 months.
Right.
And they, you know, we had a protest outside their shareholder meeting. We had tested their products. We had tested some Always pads.
Yep.
Found acetone, found chloroform, found just some really questionable things. And all we wanted to know is, why are these things in there? What do you know about these? You know, how are you working to make the product safe? And what are you disclosing about your product? And since then, they've started to work on that. You know, they're not sure why some of those things are in there, and they're working on it. And some of this is supply chain issues.
Yep.
We understand that this stuff is complicated, and we're not faulting companies for that, but we're trying to shift the paradigm to help realize that we want these processes to be safe from every point. You know, from extraction to disposal, like. Mm-hmm. This whole chain of production and consumption, it should be clean and healthy. And we think we're innovative enough that we can do that as a society. And companies are really innovative. And so if they take some of their, you know, they have really great marketing campaigns. Perhaps some of that marketing money could instead go into R&D around for green chemistry, for finding solutions. Like, let's make sure the very basic building blocks of our products are not petro-based chemicals that are contributing to climate change, but maybe these are bio-based feedstocks and these can be healthy, you know?
Sure.
Just to look at things in a new way.
Yeah, and what you're coming with is certainly a reasonable perspective and reasonable objectives. You mentioned a minute ago the lack of data in certain instances. And I was thinking throughout this conversation about what are the sort of sources of data and the constituents or participants that create that data. So I assume you've got the companies doing some of their own testing in some areas better than others.
Yeah.
And then you've got regulators, but you've also got, you know, academic researchers, third-party researchers. You got to probably ask questions about who's funding that research and all these different sources of data. How do you guys operate in that space?
Yeah. So what we typically do whenever we start a campaign is we start by looking at the science.
Mm-hmm.
So our director of science and research, she does basically a lit review. And so she rounds up any literature that's out there that we can find. Lots of the studies that are found are independent research. There's very little regulatory research available on this stuff.
Okay.
Sometimes we have some EPA data. Sometimes we have some National Institutes of Health data. A lot of the research is industry-funded research. And sometimes when you start digging into the citations, you can't actually get to a source that shows the actual study, which is pretty troubling.
Oh, you can't get to the source data?
Yeah, you can't always get to the source data, even in the journals that it's published in.
Interesting.
I'm like, well, that's fascinating. We've done a couple reports kind of exposing this because there are these sort of quasi-regulatory bodies right now that are really in charge of cosmetic safety. And they're essentially who our government relies on. This is who the FDA is relying on to make a call about whether a product is safe. And they have really, you know, they have a lot of gaps in the data knowledge and also just a lot of inherent conflicts of interest with the industry. So the data is a challenge. So, you know, we round it up from wherever we can. But a lot of times what our work is pointing out is here's what we know about a certain chemical. We may not have research on how this chemical is working in this particular product or what health impact it's going to have from this intended use of this product. But we have research about a chemical itself.
Okay.
And so that's where we start to ask questions like, well, how have you done? What is the research you've done? Because you are the company who has to make sure your products are safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're asking right now for them to make that research publicly available. And Procter & Gamble actually just put out, I think it was last month, their 2030, it's like 2030 sustainability goals or something like that. And they are pledging to make public a lot of their research. So this message is starting to be heard, and we're excited to see progress and see that, you know, okay, maybe we're wrong about all of this. Then let's put out the research. Let's see it. And let's open this conversation up further.
Yeah. So, and that leads me into kind of a question about, and this is more in your wheelhouse as executive director, I would suppose. It's like you've got this portfolio of tools to affect change. Part of those tools are affecting consumer demand, getting consumers to put, you know, to vote with their dollar bills, to vote with their pocketbook, so to speak. But then you've also got activism and engagement, and a lot of the successes you've mentioned in this conversation have stemmed from first step was a protest, perhaps.
Yep.
So how do you view this, you know, the different levers you can pull to affect change in this space?
Yeah. So, I mean, our basic strategy is to kind of engage and mobilize women. And so we do this through our corporate campaigns and then through policy-based campaigns.
Okay.
So we have right now corporate campaigns on cleaning products, on feminine care products, on Brazilian blowout, really dangerous hair straightening product. And then we also engage women to actually send, you know, letters to their congresspeople. We've done rallies in D.C., lobby days in D.C. on legislation. Right now we're working mostly in California and New York on policy.
Uh-huh.
And so it's a mix of kind of organizing and mobilizing women towards our specific campaign goals. That's really what our strategy is.
Okay. And within that, too, what's the balance between, you know, changing individual level behavior versus changing regulation? Like, where do you think, you know, where do you move the ball the greatest distance? I don't know what analogy to use there, but you get what I'm asking.
Yeah. So, I mean, we actually have lots of tips and resources on our website.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Because a lot of times people are not thinking about the advocacy when they come to our organization. They, a lot of times women have gotten pregnant and they're suddenly concerned about the health of their unborn baby. And so we have, pregnancy and toxic chemicals. Like, what can you do as a pregnant woman? So we have fact sheets. We have top 10 tips for reducing your exposure, things you can do in the house. We have a business partners program. So we actually do partner with companies. We have partnerships with Seventh Generation, with the Honest Company, Sustain. They do condoms and feminine care products, NatraCare, several companies are on our website. And so we are trying to show that it's possible to have safe and healthy products. It's not like you just can't have anything. Sometimes access is limited to those products, whether geographically you just can't get it or you don't have enough money, or hey, you're a homeless woman and you need a tampon, it's going to be whatever you can find. You're not going to worry about, you know, which one you're getting. So we, you know, I think it's a real entry point to want to change your own life. And that's great. And that's also things we should all do because it does move the market.
Yes.
And so to the extent that we can make safer choices, it's great. And it helps in the household. There have been really interesting pieces of research about, like it was a biomonitoring study where they tested urine samples of women. There's been a couple of different kinds. So one example is these women gave a urine sample and were tested for BPA, bisphenol A, which is a chemical that's found like in can linings.
Yep. And that was a big water bottle scandal years ago.
Yes.
And Nalgene and others. Yeah.
Exactly. And these women, got their levels tested and then they had to work to not eat. I think they just didn't eat canned food for a week. And their levels of the BPA dropped in the secondary urine sample.
Okay.
That's also happened with cosmetics testing. A group of teens, low-income teens out of California did this where it was phthalates was the chemical they were testing for. And they had a baseline level of this chemical. They stopped using their regular cosmetics and used other alternative products, and their level of phthalates had dropped in a week. So you can, you know, you can make some personal changes in your own exposure, and that's important. And so we have tips and recommendations and suggestions for other products to buy on our website.
Sure.
But then we also want people to start taking the next step, because the reality is, like, we can all change our products, but there's still so many, you know, we will never be able to shop our way out of this problem.
Okay.
Ultimately. So yeah. Let's make some shopping changes that we can. And some just aren't realistic, especially if you are a person living here in Missoula, like buying an $8,000 flame return free couch, not really on the table for most of us.
Sure.
So we have to get the manufacturers to change and to ultimately change the system. And that's what we're looking to do, is provide women a gateway, information they can come in, and then we help them take steps to start taking action. And it's been really encouraging because, you know, we, like, after we did the protest at Procter & Gamble, you know, it was like, okay, we showed up, and they put up ingredient disclosure pages for their tampons and pads that day.
Yeah, you guys now have a place at the table.
You
know, regular discussions.
And we just, the response we got from one was like, I can't believe we did it. We actually did it. Like, we changed a multinational company.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a voice. And I think that the more women get involved and start to see that, it's really empowering. And then we can really start to move the needle together.
Yeah, and as in your role as executive director, like, as we think about this, Aaron, I just think, like, I mean, the this was the title of the book, Mountains Beyond Mountains, about public health, right? That this is one of those things that is so big, so vast. How do you, as a leader of this organization, set parameters? What are the guardrails for this is the sort of issue we're going to get into, this is what we're not going to touch, like, we're going to stay on cosmetics, we're not going to do food. Where do you kind of draw these lines and how?
Yeah, it's hard. But we actually have just wrapped up a big kind of 10-year strategic visioning process.
Okay.
And we have just been really clear that, okay, we see this as a huge systemic problem of toxic chemicals in our lives coming from various sources. But where we can make an impact is focusing on the product, the industries that most heavily and intimately market to women.
Okay.
And so that's where we narrow our focus. So currently it's looking at cosmetics, cleaning products, fragrance, which spans actually a number of industries, salon products, feminine care products.
Yep.
And then where we're looking to in the future is apparel, textiles. That's a really, really dirty industry.
Mm.
That one is challenging, though, because it's the solutions are just not as tangible. Like, really finding an easy, better solution around apparel right now is pretty hard. So that is something that that's starting to evolve. But what we're also concerned about is, well, gosh, if, you know, here in the U.S., we have exposures but where these chemicals are sourced and manufactured, the chemical processing plants, those communities are really, really harmed. And so that's the other thing is how can we, you know, start to change things so that it can trickle back to those communities eventually and say, okay, well, let's clean up these chemical processing plants. Like, all of these people are very sick because these chemicals are being processed in their communities. Those are ending up in our products. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a surprisingly large amount. I think it's about 40% of what is going through a chemical processing plant ends up back out in consumer products.
Wow.
It's a lot. So
yeah, that's scary.
Yeah. And so through that, really, that work is, we know that's not our work. That's not what we directly do, but that's where we forge partnerships and allyships to try to support other organizations.
Yeah. And I guess this is, you know, we had this conversation before we started recording, but, you know, some of these impacts that, or the, you know, the effects of exposure to these chemicals are the common things like cancers and asthma and other sort of very kind of salient, known, discrete outcomes in a way. But one of the things you brought up were, you know, a lot of these chemicals or some of these chemicals are being found to have effects on our adrenal system and things that maybe operate in terms of suboptimal health in ways that are less clear to observe. Does that make sense?
Yeah. The kind of biggest example right now is the case of endocrine disrupting chemicals. So there are so many chemicals that are put into products that are basically, the effect that they're having is that they're mimicking how our hormones function. Mm-hmm. And this has huge implications for our reproductive systems. And there's an organization called the Endocrine Exchange where they're amazing. They do incredible research on this, and they have actually been able to look at the impacts of endocrine-disrupting chemicals at different periods during a woman's pregnancy and figure out, like, what the potential health effects are.
For the mom or for the baby?
For the
baby.
For both? It could be that, you know, it's like, gosh, if the mother was exposed to this tiny, tiny, tiny amount of this chemical in her first trimester, like the baby's now, you know, 10 times more likely, and I'm making these stats up, but, you know, 10 times more likely to have learning disabilities.
Sure.
I can't remember the stats off the top of my head, but it's got these really specific health effects.
Yeah.
And what that tells us is that the way that most of the assessment for chemicals is done right now is that companies they're doing a risk assessment. And so they're assuming that this chemical is safe if used in this amount. You know, if the product is used the way that it was intended, and they say this amount of chemical is safe, and then they basically say, and we're going to add 1,000 times to that to make sure we have a window.
Okay.
But what we're finding with these endocrine-disrupting chemicals, these hormone mimickers, is that rule is just doesn't work that way. So we're actually seeing sometimes greater health effects from a tinier exposure than if you had a large dose exposure.
Okay.
So it's really turned everything on its head, and it just makes it all the more clear to me that the right question is not how much is safe, but okay, if there's risk to this, let's not use it. Let's find something that's inherently safe to the best that we can. And those solutions are still being developed and worked out, but that's the goal, and that's where we need to start to get. And I think right now we at least have enough data on so many of these chemicals to say, like, whoa, you're flagged. We're gonna look for something that has the same function, but that's not so flagged. Or, you know what? We can't find anything. We can't find a chemical that's safer. Do we need this product? Because maybe we really don't. Like, that's another question we need to ask. And that's something that I, you know, that we ask women all the time too, is like, you know, do you need a spray cleaner and a bathtub cleaner and a toilet bowl cleaner and, you know, all these cleaners that are marketed for a specific purpose?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
When really what you need is a spray bottle of vinegar and water. Mm-hmm. That's what we use to clean with
it.
It does the job.
Yeah.
So,
gosh, Aaron, so many. I mean, this is like questions lead to questions, and
yes,
and we could go down many, many rabbit holes, but just inspired by the kind of ability of your organization to tackle such a colossal problem and put together a set of real wins. I mean, you guys are doing amazing work, and that's wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's exciting, yeah.
So how can people interested in getting involved, learning more, whether it's making changes in their personal life or going to a protest or engaging or writing letters, how can they learn more about your work and get involved?
Yeah, our website or our Facebook page are great places to get involved. The website is womensvoices.org.
Okay.
You can find us on Facebook at Women's Voices for the Earth. And just sign up for our e-news. Just start there. You get a newsletter. Our website has lots of resources, tips, fact sheets, information. And if you want to start taking action, we'll send you action alerts. You can sign up for text alerts. Lots of ways to get involved and lots of levels of engagement available too.
Super. Well, Aaron, thanks for sharing your story with us, and all the best in your important work.
Awesome. Thank you, Justin. Thanks for having me.
All right. That was a fun one. Inspiring work by Aaron and her team over at Women's Voices for the Earth. I encourage you to check out their website and get involved and learn more. Learn more about what you can do both at the household level, but also as far as getting involved in a protest. I mean, you heard that was her entry path into this line of work, and it's pretty inspiring. All right, coming up next week, we've got Bjorn Nabosny, another Missoula legend, the co-founder of Big Sky Brewing. So it was a super fun interview. We did it on location, and I'm excited to bring that to you next week. Remember that A New Angle was brought to you by CED, Consolidated Electrical Distributors. They're one of the largest electrical wholesale companies in the country with nearly 600 locations nationwide. CED is a privately owned business-to-business company that distributes just about every piece of equipment to keep your lights on, your energy flowing, and your lifestyle comfortable. CED is also an important employer in Missoula, and they have a keen interest in University of Montana graduates. To explore career opportunities, check out www.cedcareers.com. Moving forward, if you have any suggestions for guests, cool people doing awesome things with creativity and hustle, please let us know. And if you enjoy this podcast, there are several ways you can support it. First, rate us on iTunes. Ratings help others find the show. Second, write a review. The more reviews we get, and hopefully positive ones, the more we can grow. And third, please just tell your friends about it. In addition, you can support A New Angle financially. For information on sponsorship opportunities, please visit our website, www.business.umt.edu/anewangle. There you will also find a link to support the pod. Before we go, I'd like to thank a few people for making this project happen. First of all, Elizabeth Willey, Communications Director here at the University of Montana College of Business. I'd also like to thank recent UM graduate Michelle DeFluke and our fabulous interns Savannah Sletton and Max Gibson. And a special thanks to VTO for providing the show with music. Finally, thanks to my producer, Stefan Borsum. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, insults, whatever, please email me at anewangle@umontana.edu. Help us spread the word and be sure to use the hashtag #anewangle when you do. Thanks a lot and see you next time.